Welcome to Shades of Freedom from the Aspen Institute's Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. Be sure to never miss an episode by subscribing to Shades of Freedom on your favorite podcast app. This episode's guest is Daniel Nishanian, editor-in-chief and founder of the digital magazine Bolts.
The media that covers electoral politics, you know, there's a kind of convention that you sort of take the rules of the game at face value and you're like, okay, who is going to win within the rules of the game? But when the rules of the game, like in Florida, involve, you know, a poll tax, or in Tennessee involve 1 in 5 black residents not being allowed to vote, it demands kind of a different sort of thinking of how we're going to talk about these elections that do matter.
Welcome to Shades of Freedom. I'm your host, Douglas Wood, director of the Aspen Institute's Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. Today's guest is Daniel Nishanian. Daniel is editor and founder of Bolts, a digital publication that covers the nuts and bolts of power and political change from the local level up, with a focus on criminal justice and voting rights. Daniel is a journalist whose writing, in his words, works to shed light on the political and ideological conflicts that shape local criminal legal systems. From 2018 to June 2021, Daniel was the founding editor and editorial director of the Appeal Political Report. His pieces have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Vox, and many more publications. He received a PhD in political theory from the University of Chicago and undergraduate degrees in philosophy and political science from Yale. It's an honor to have him on our show today. Daniel, welcome to Shades of Freedom.
It's great to join you. Thank you for having me.
Daniel, how did you find your way into political journalism, and specifically journalism on criminal justice?
I was writing about American elections and American politics in college, or after college, in my first job in journalism, and then really stopped all that and went into academia, as you mentioned, and was doing a PhD in political theory, and that was very much about thinking about some of these questions and movement politics and defiance towards institutional work and trying to participate in government. And part of that involved, obviously thinking about racial justice issues in the U.S. specific, and voting rights issues, and specifically voting rights for people with criminal convictions, and some of the history of that, and was writing about that, and obviously was interested in the criminal justice system already, and continued writing more about criminal justice. And then when I wanted to kind of find a way out of academia back in 2018, started to work at The Appeal, and really made this more of a regular beat to think about some of these institutions that we're talking about. And I think coming at it from a place where I really cared about institutional change and avenues of power, but also realizing that it was very hard to conceptualize that when it came to criminal justice, because there isn't even really a place to start to think about it. Like, I guess I wanted to know more about what was going on. This was, I guess, the Chicago DA election moment, the Krasner election, but it was just very hard to think about what was happening elsewhere because there just wasn't that much coverage, there wasn't that much attention, and just starting to build a platform where we can think about that more systematically was kind of the initial effort into, frankly, also realizing that these are similar issues that are happening on other matters, right? I think the theory of it for me started around criminal justice, but then the like underlying idea that there's a massive issue in how we think about local institutions applies to housing or immigration or transit and so on. So that's how I got to Bolts.
Let's jump right into Bolts. Your About page says of Bolts, and I quote, "Bolts is a digital magazine that covers the nuts and bolts of power and political change from the local up. We report on the local elections and obscure institutions that shape public policy but are dangerously overlooked, and the grassroots movements that are targeting them. Why focus on local elections and overlooked institutions that shape public policy?"
Yeah, I think for many people who probably are going to hear this podcast, who care about these issues that we're going to talk about, And millions of Americans, there's often a reflex to look at Washington, D.C., right? There's a reflex to look at the federal government. And in many ways, it's very justified. No, there's no argument here that the federal government doesn't matter or that one single voting rights bill wouldn't make a humongous difference for so many people across the country. But what ends up really being overlooked, underappreciated, under theorized, often to use a more theoretical word, is the all the levers and levels of power and authority that exist in this country that are often literally underused in the sense that no one is running for them, no one has a platform for them, no one has a theory of how they can be participating in change in. Radical change and incremental change or whatnot. And, you know, I think anyone who cares about criminal justice, the criminal justice policy, I think really understands that much more than I think on many other issues, just because the state and local institutions of criminal justice are so important compared to the federal government's role or the role of state prisons, the size of state prisons and local jails compared to federal prisons. You know, but I think there's a new issue there that emerges from the fact that there are 3,000 counties, right? And like, I think a lot of people have heard of San Francisco's DA, who's up for a recall a few days from when we are recording this conversation. But there are literally hundreds of other prosecutors, many other offices that are impacting people's lives so hugely. And you can make the same analysis on other issues like voting rights, civil rights, and frankly anything. And I think what we're very excited to do at Bolts is address that, give people a place to come to think about these institutions and what is being done with them, and also start having resources, databases that can inform them of who has the power to do what and what they're doing with it.
You know, when I was at the Ford Foundation, we recognized the need to invest in the civic infrastructure of institutions in underserved parts of the country. Can you say more about the challenges around the dearth of public resources supporting local institutions, which you just referred to?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I try to talk about this, it sounds almost weird or silly because the level of informational gap is so basic that when you say the sort of things that we don't even have information about, when we try to even think about this, it sounds like you're making it up. Like the fact, if someone asks when are the DAs of New York elected, in case they want to think about it or they want to think about who should run or just the platforms or what questions to ask of candidates, right? Like the type of questions we know to think about in other offices, there is no centralized database. There is nowhere to look to even start knowing. When I was trying to figure out a few years ago who was even literally going to running for prosecutor in New York, some county offices were asking for freedom of information requests, just literally know who had filed to office after the filing deadline. It's a feature, not a bug, in a way, where the ability to follow local policies and local institutions is made very difficult in some places much more than others, and that prevents the ability to engage, to understand the powers of these people, to understand what sort of questions to ask. Obviously, a related issue in many places is that local news is finding it is in grave difficulty, right? Again, that is very, very, very different from place to place, and a lot of places there are great media organizations doing a lot of great work, but you know, or don't have enough resources to do as much as they could, and that's all very important, especially when you consider that there's a tradition that prosecutors, sheriffs, local officials that have the power on these issues like to act like they don't have any political role or they don't make policy, right? They like to act that they're just applying the law.
I referred to this earlier, but what do you mean when you refer to the grassroots movements that are targeting local institutions?
I think there's always a lot of civil rights movements around criminal justice in the U.S. I think what has been interesting to follow, obviously, over the past 6-7 years is new forms of institutional engagement on their part, of thinking about the role of prosecutors and in particular, but also mayors, et cetera, differently. I mean, that itself comes with a certain ambivalence which is also very interesting to think about and talk about. And but there are new questions being raised and there are new forms of pressure that have also become much more visible and much more mainstream and are now occasioning new forms of, you know, blowback on the part of law enforcement lobbies and on the part of centrist Democrats and conservatives. And I think we're really seeing that. I mean, again, I'm going to refer to something that's happening in a few days from when we were recording, but there's so much new visibility in some ways in California, for instance, around jail conditions as part of what people are talking about in local elections. You know, it hasn't broken through necessarily every newspapers, but I think the fact that the institutional rhythms and policy questions are opportunities to inject some of these very, very important life and death questions into the political conversation is coming to fruition increasingly.
And what do you hope to accomplish through the publication of Bolt?
Well, I think first and foremost, the informational void that I've been describing weakens engagement and civic engagement broadly and specifically also among people who do want institutional change, right? Including fairly strong institutional change. And being able to both be a place that injects some of these issues in the conversation and I think really translates the big picture thoughts, the big picture awareness people have of the importance of local institutions into the actual spaces where these movements are happening and the demands are happening. I think that translation is usually what's missing, and the tools to do that translation as well, by which I mean, you know, you can be aware, to take an example, maybe a step away from criminal justice for a second, because that is what comes to mind. There's increasing attention, increasing awareness, rather, that there is a threat of election subversion in the U.S., right, that comes from state and local institutions running elections and Donald Trump's effort to take over some of these offices. There's a lot of attention that there's a lot of kind of very big picture articles in the press nationally that are very good, but that kind of like pose that question, pose that challenge. A lot of people were like very agitated by it. That doesn't mean you then know where are the threats? What is the power of the Michigan Secretary of State versus Ohio's? Who is running? What might they do? What are the county clerks that are doing X or Y? What's the difference in the system in Arizona or Michigan? There's a lot of work of translation to be done there, both in terms of the reporting and information, but also in terms of just having the information.
So building on that, it's a related question. In addition to criminal justice, I know that voting rights is a priority for your work with Bolt. Can you say more about what you see as the intersection with both, particularly in the context of the political system being used to criminalize access to democracy?
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't have to be naive and think that the criminalization of democracy started yesterday. Obviously, it's like a very, very long process that dates as long as people wanted to exclude Black Americans from the ballot. But it is also true that in recent years, there's an increasingly sort of a template of bills that are being passed in a lot of states that are creating new criminal charges and are trying to bring the criminal legal system and prosecutors and police and law enforcement to bear in new ways on all sorts of practices that really are at the core of how we engage elections and more broadly protests and democracy. You know, this has a connection to the environmental protests and the pipeline protests in a lot of states, where a lot of Republicans started passing laws to criminalize forms of protests. It has obviously also applied in a lot of responses to BLM in 2020, and now as well in the response to the false claims of fraud after the 2020 presidential election. There are offices being created to police elections, to prosecute elections, and, you know, no matter the size of these offices, the intimidation factor is obviously extremely important. That is also a very common tool in American history. And we are seeing that. We are seeing very high-profile cases, right, of typically Black Americans that are being prosecuted for a voting error, ending up with years in prison for a voting error. You know, and as the media, it's a bit of a tricky situation, because on the one hand, you don't want to act like that's not happening because it's such egregious cases of people being put in prison for years over a voting error. On the other hand, part of the rationale of that sort of prosecution is the intimidation factor. And obviously when that gets more attention, that obviously plays up the potential reactions people have when they see the news and they think about, wait, am I able to vote? What happens if I make a mistake? It also opens major questions of what it means to cover electoral politics in a situation of mass exclusion and of criminalization. I think the media that covers electoral politics, you know, there's a kind of convention that you sort of take the rules of the game at face value, and you're like, okay, who is going to win within the rules of the game? But when the rules of the game, like in Florida, involve, you know, a poll tax, or in Tennessee involve 1 in 5 black residents not being allowed to vote, it demands kind of a different sort of thinking of how we're going to talk about these elections that do matter, or these institutional spaces that, like, who has the seats of power, obviously is very important, but the rules of the game are themselves skewed, and that is a problem with how we cover these spaces usually. One interesting example right now, right, on criminal justice. A year ago, around this time, every national publication went to Philadelphia and ran an article about how Larry Krasner's re-election race is a test for criminal justice reform. Larry Krasner being the DA of Philadelphia, who's one of the better known reform DAs in the country. And there was so much, you know, so much focus as that as a big test. Then Krasner won very easily. I guess we didn't really hear much about Krasner again. Now the same thing is happening with Chesa Abudin in San Francisco. I have no particular inside knowledge, but the polls that are out there indicate that he will lose, which is obviously extremely important and will have very important consequences for San Francisco and the country. But, you know, there is the same decision that this is the one race that everyone's going to talk about, and then everyone's going to obviously draw a lot of. Lessons from it, right? The fact that there's so many other elections happening in Iowa on the same day, in California, all around the state, that might have different lessons or not, is not going to register. There's going to be that one election everyone has chosen to go after is going to kind of set the tone for a national conversations on criminal justice reform.
So what do you think is going to be the backlash if you see more of these progressive DAs either losing elections or having recall elections? What do you think is going to be the backlash in the country around discussions on national criminal justice reform efforts?
I think we're already in the blowback, right? We're already living it, certainly at the level of national politics. I think we're obviously a very far cry away from where the national, federal, maybe, conversation was a year ago or a year and a half ago. At the local level, I guess what I'm trying to think about is how to resist kind of overarching takeaways. Because I think we are used to the seesawing nature of what side wins elections or who has the upper hand at various moments, because there's a lot of people at the local level that are doing the work that are making decisions based on harm reduction strategies, often about whether it is worth thinking about a local election as part of their strategies or not, right?
What do you see as the interplay between local justice reforms and national reforms being debated right now, and how are they interconnected?
If by national reform we mean things that are being discussed maybe at the federal level rather than things that are being sort of proposed in a number of places, and because that's sort of a different dynamic. One thing that really strikes me is that the audiences of the debates happening at these different levels are so different, right? The audience that people who want to pass municipal change have to convince or are talking to when in the course of their advocacy or protest or organizing versus the type of audiences that the decision makers at the federal level are thinking about and are trying to win over or not antagonize are just so different that it does create creates, I think, a very large gap between those conversations. But also, you know, I think you often hear it in federal conversations, commentators, perhaps with good reason, be asking about the effects of emphasizing criminal justice reform or incarceration issues, or the police, obviously, on the fate of Democratic candidates in rural areas or in places that Democrats have to win for federal power. That is not necessarily a concern that the activists who are asking for change in Philly or LA or San Francisco should care about, or in any case will care about in the same way. And so I think that gets to what I was saying when I was saying that the lessons that will be taken at the federal level and at the state and local level will be very different, and probably should be very different in that sense.
Can you give us a quick sort of landscaping analysis of the local elections we should be watching, in addition to the Bodine recall election? Are there others that would have major implications, both at the local and national level, that our audience should be aware of and should be following?
Ooh, there's really so much. You know, there's also a lot of sheriff elections that are playing out in a lot of places. Jail conditions obviously are very interesting. We're also seeing maybe, we haven't really talked about this very much, but immigration enforcement continues to be an interesting fault line in a lot of these local elections. And I say continues to be because, you know, there has been a drop of attention to immigration enforcement at the local level since Donald Trump came out of office. So one question I have for 2022 is whether immigrant rights activists are going to continue being able to draw attention to the role that local sheriffs or mayors or others are playing in collaborating with ICE. That's something that actually was one of the more successful use of electoral avenues in 2018 and 2020 to oust officials locally who were collaborating with ICE. Definitely a very, very large number. And we, you know, in places like Wake County in North Carolina comes to mind, where a Republican sheriff who was ousted over ICE collaboration is trying to get his job back and bring back ICE collaboration. You know, it's not necessarily the kind of elections you hear about too much, but they're really so important.
We always ask our guests the same final question, which is, when you hear the words shades of freedom, what does it mean to you now and into the future?
Yeah, there's so many places to take that question. What does come to mind is the idea, the notion of building up and enjoying the power to shape your life and the life of those around you and of your community, right? And of course, the criminal legal system has, throughout U.S. history, but as we were discussing also recently, been used to make that ideal, that notion, very difficult for a lot of people, especially Black Americans. And that's one reason why, you know, a lot of I do a fair amount of writing on the question of voting rights for people with criminal convictions, not just because of the actual rights of people to vote, but also because it's symptomatic, right, of the way in which this ideal of the democratic freedom is weakened by the criminal legal system. But it's also why I think it's particularly interesting to see the response to that, and this gets to your question about grassroots movements that have been happening, to see the visions, the positive visions of change about that system that have been in play, that people are organizing around, including many people who have lost the right to vote, right, but are continuing to exercise their voices in alternative ways. And yeah, maybe to end on a sour on a depressing note rather than a positive one, it's also concerning how much intellectual heft is being deployed on parts of the right now to deny ideals of universal empowerment, universal suffrage, to actively argue that some people lack the civic virtue to participate in democracy, to be good citizens, which itself is very racialized discourse. We're seeing it in how it's being deployed against the weight of urban areas to vote, in which it's being deployed to deny the right to vote to anyone in Washington, D.C. for Congress. So there's really like a battle right now, concerningly, around the very notion of universal empowerment and democratic freedom, which is entangled in the criminal legal system and also in what's happening on voting rights. And yeah, so that's the state of the country right now, I fear.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. It's been a pleasure having you on Shades of Freedom. We wish you all the best in the publication of Bolts, and thank you for encouraging our listeners to pay attention to local elections and voting rights issues going on in the country now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us for Shades of Freedom from the Aspen Institute's Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking guests, so please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Or you can find all of our past episodes by visiting our website at www.aspeninstitute.org/CJRI. This podcast was engineered and produced by Natalie Jones, with research assistance by Willem Patrick. It was edited by Ken Thompson, with production support by Christian Devers and Wanda Mann. CJRI's programs were made possible by support from Arnold Ventures, The Balmer Group, The Bank of America Charitable Foundation, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the Community Foundation for Southeast Michigan, the Ford Foundation, and Slack, Inc.